Good evening, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us. This is a multi-level, multi-geographical event. So in black, you love this, in black, Brian Freeman at the top, no longer in Minnesota, but now basking in Florida, where, what is it, like 100?
Just about.
Yeah. Teach you to leave Minnesota.
Check with me in January.
Brian is the author of The Bourne Defiance, and is illustrative of that section of publishing, which is called legacy or franchise publishing, in a sense that he is continuing the characters that were created by a different author. And that is a big thing and wonderful for fans who do not have to then mourn the demise of a favorite character. Now, the other guy in black at the bottom of the screen, not the one in the middle, we'll get to him in a minute. This is Brandon Webb, am I right?
That's it.
Wonderful. And in blue, just for contrast, is his writing partner, David Mann. And they have, you can hold it up, they have a book called Blind Fear, right? And Blind Fear is illustrative of another thing that's happening, is that we are getting new writing with a pair of authors. So there are two or three pairs on the scene writing military fiction together. And if any of you watched our Brad Thor program last night, Brad is thinking about taking on some partner authors, which he outlined. And sort of shares the load, right, for research and so forth. Don, don't pay any attention to this, because I don't want you to do that, at least not yet. Right. And our genial host, the guy in the middle in the black, depending on how your Zoom screen is, wave at us, is Don Bentley, who is my go-to guy for military fiction and all other kinds of fiction, and is a brilliant host. So he's going to be talking to Brandon and Webb, and I will be talking to Brian, or rather, I'll be listening to Brian, because Brian actually hardly needs anyone to talk to. One of the things I love about doing this with Brian. So we do have autographed copies of the Bourne Identity, the Bourne Defiance in the bookstore. And currently,
call it Bourne Identity if you want. I have no problem with that.
Defiance is a great title.
Thank you.
Oh, maybe that'll be next. Right. Anyway, somewhere in New York.
Big Bourne fan, by the way.
Theoretically moving towards us are autographed copies of Blind Fear, signed by both Mann and Webb, courtesy of the Mysterious Bookshop, where they have appeared earlier this evening. So they too are on a doubleheader. Now, Don, I have to mention this at my every opportunity, Don will be back at the Poison Pen on September 11th with a Tom Clancy Jack Ryan Jr. book, the name of which I can't recall. It's Tom Clancy's what?
Weapons Grade.
Thank you, Weapons Grade. And he will be accepting the handoff from Kyle Mills for Kyle's final novel in the Vince Flynn universe. So lots going on here tonight.
Legacy.
Multi-talents. Brian, I forgot to mention, also writes books of his very own under Brian Freeman for a different publisher. And in fact, has written a very long-running, wonderful series of police novels set in Duluth, where he's no longer residing. But where I, Brian, am visiting on September 10th. And I will say that the thing I'm most looking forward to is visiting the surf shop, because Duluth has become the surf capital of the Midwest. And an enterprising guy from California has opened a surf shop in Duluth with a branch coming. Yeah, I love that.
They grow them pretty crazy up there.
So what is it that, what would be the demand for a surf shop in Duluth, Minnesota?
It's a big thing up there. When those gales start rolling on Lake Superior, the surfers come up there, and they don't really have the sand beaches in quite the same way. So you got to be a little careful what you're landing on. But it's an outdoorsy town up there, and they love their surfing. So.
Oh, it'll be fun. We're going to take a cruise at the Great Lakes that goes from Duluth to Toronto, which is why going to Duluth. So I'm really looking forward to it. So Don, why don't you kick us off? Brian and I will lurk here for a few minutes. And why don't you talk to Mann and Webb and kind of get
sure. Well, again, fantastic book. It's the third book in their series called Blind Fear. So it's great to meet both of you. John David Mann is a pretty incredible and well-known author, and Brandon Webb among other things, is a Navy SEAL. And so I will use small words, Brandon, very, very small words when I talk to you. No, my friend's an Army Ranger. He told me to say that. You can't hold that against me. And I'm only doing that because you're far away from me right now. So I.
Wait, he's Army? Is he an Army guy? Yeah,
yes, yes. He was an Army Ranger.
I've got a Ranger friend. He says he only uses $7 words compared to those
SEALs. So. In all fairness, the entrance exam is quite a bit lower for the Army. If we want to just lay the facts on the table,
I mean, I'm not going to dispute that. I'm not going to dispute that. But since I'm doing the questioning, I get to make the jokes, Brandon. That's kind of how this works right here. No, seriously. So I'm going to ask the two of you the question that every author is terrified to answer, and that is, tell us what Blind Fear is actually about, and maybe as part of that, introduce us to your character, Finn. For those folks who are maybe starting the series with Blind Fear.
Go for it, John.
Okay, then I will. Brandon says go for it, I go for it. It's the third book in the series, as we said, and they're all starring Chief Finn, no last name, or maybe he doesn't remember his last name, or we're not sure yet. Finn's own past is as mysterious to himself as it is to everybody else. Finn is an active duty Navy SEAL, but by book two, he is a fugitive from the law, accused of war crimes that he's pretty sure he didn't commit. And by book three, he's like really sure he didn't commit them, but he's looking for the guy who did. And so book three finds him. Book one finds him in an aircraft carrier. Book two is set in Reykjavik, Iceland. Book three finds him hiding out in a back room behind a little cafe in Vieques off Puerto Rico. And he's working for a blind old chef.
And it's a great, oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, you take it.
No. And it's a fantastic book. It's a fantastic story. The atmosphere and stuff is incredible, but I want to do one more stage setting question. And so in all seriousness, Brandon has a pretty incredible background and a stellar career as a Navy SEAL. And so I guess, Brandon, can you weigh in a little bit? Obviously, it isn't happenstance that Finn is the SEAL as well. And so maybe talk a little bit about why you decided to write a book about a Navy SEAL, how much of Finn comes from you. Kind of cue us into that a little bit.
Sure. So John and I met many, many moons ago, and we collaborated on the first book I did called The Red Circle. All those years back, before I was a Navy SEAL, I was a search and rescue swimmer in helicopters with HS6 out of San Diego. And I was on the aircraft carrier, the USS Abraham Lincoln, and we had a sexual predator on the boat. They'd introduced women on the ship, and they never caught this guy. The captain of the Lincoln was just not a very good leader. Anyone that's served in the military has been in that environment where you have a really bad commanding officer. The ship morale was low. Obviously, my helicopter squadron had a separate commanding officer, but the ship's captain the Lincoln had the worst accident rate in the fleet. We had the sexual predator on the loose that assaulted, I think, 7 women, and they never caught him. So it just planted the seed in me many years later as I'm kicking off my writing career. Like I told John way back when, I said, like, imagine if it was a serial killer like Hannibal Lecter on this aircraft carrier, because the military environment's not equipped to deal with complex crime like that. So that was the kind of seed that took place. And John and I, to be honest, I don't think we intended writing a series. We wanted to write this story, which we did. Yeah. And our editor, who ended up buying the book, Ann Spire, she said, look, guys, you got to write a series. Like, this is not one and done. So that was kind of the kind of origin of the Finn series. You know, obviously, you know, John and I come from very diverse backgrounds. You know, his career as a musician, and you know, my career as a SEAL. I think we just something works there, and a lot of the character development, I think, you know, John and I have so much rich material to pull from. But in all credit, I told it the same tonight at in New York. John, you know, I came up with a story, but Finn is, to his credit, like he really dug in and carved Finn out of stone, and that's his creation. Obviously, there's a lot of, I think, my experience tied to Finn.
Yeah.
I think I made a long story longer there with that answer, but
I think I got it. No. That's exactly what I was trying to get at, because the what I love about what you guys do is, so my editor's Tom Colgan, and I wrote 3 books that didn't sell before I finally wrote a 4th that did. And he said, you know, this genre is so competitive that when you're trying to sell a book and you're a newcomer, you got to do something that's the same but different. And so Brad Taylor's a great friend of mine. I'm never going to write a better Brad Taylor book than he does. So I had to figure out, what can I do that I belong in that same genre but is different? And I think you guys nailed that, because your main character is obviously a SEAL, and your first book has more of a military focus. You know, it takes place on the aircraft carrier. Your second book does not, but he's going after rogue Navy SEALs. And then your third book is, it's almost more like a Lee Child vibe, where you have a character who happens to have served in the military, but it really is a completely different story. And so, was that an intentional progression? Was that something you guys set out to do, or kind of how did that happen?
Well, I'll answer first and I'll let Sean go. But Finn, even though he's a Navy SEAL, he's definitely not painted as a Navy SEAL. Like, he's not, I would say, the stereotypical Navy SEAL. And that was intentional for sure. You know, I remember the first scene where he's kind of getting on, boarding a helicopter to fly out to the aircraft carrier, a big guy next to Finn, and he's like this skinny, lanky character. And then, you know, the pilots are like, oh, there's the big Navy SEAL, and it's not. Finn is very much not what you would think a Navy SEAL is. But go ahead, John. You want to add to that?
Yeah, man, I think you're absolutely right. And it's kind of like he's sort of the military, but he's also not of the military. He is a loner. Mm-hmm. It's kind of the best of both worlds. We get to plug him into this huge military machine in terms of his background, but functionally he is like Jack Reacher. I mean, he's kind of out on his own. And practically speaking, right now he's a fugitive because of his accusations. Will he get back with the service? Will he get back with his unit? I mean, that's an unknown, but we kind of pulled him out of the military and sucked him out of that. And our intention was to throw him into a very different world every book. And that'll keep going in future. Mm-hmm. We like to take a new, different challenge with every book, so it doesn't get old and retreaded.
And we're mixing genre too, right? Crime, military thriller. We did, to your point, I agree with you on that. It's a crowded genre, and you really have to bring it. And I think that the one thing we did to kick off the series was, no one had ever done a serial killer on an aircraft carrier.
Yeah, that's such a good idea.
Very original. And I think that's why we're able to also option the series to Whip Studios quickly, because that was such a compelling setting. And to be honest, a cheap film to make, right? Or series, one location. Yeah.
So let me ask Don, and I'm going to interrupt you because you and Brian speak to this. What is it like to step into a universe that somebody else created and then write it the same but different? Brian, you know, you're in Treadstone. You're here with Jason Bourne. Don has been writing in the Jack Ryan universe. By the way, I thought the last Jack Ryan film that just, TV thing that was just over was really interesting the way it all played out. Do you watch it or do you avoid it? You don't want to answer. Never mind. We'll skip that question. All right, Brian. So answer my, oh, goodbye, Scooter. I'm asked my question about, you know, stepping into someone else. How do you make it, you know, the same but different for the Robert Ludlum fans?
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's clearly intimidating the first time you're going after it. I mean, I know when Tom Colgan first came to me about taking over the Bourne series, I mean, my initial reaction was, oh my God. And very quickly after that, it was, oh my God. In Ludlum is such a giant of the genre, and Bourne is such a, you know, an iconic and enduring figure. I was struggling with the idea of, you know, how do I sort of make this character my own? And I know my own characters, my own heroes really, really well. And the challenge with other people's works is always that they start feeling a little bit two dimensional because you're not immersed in the story and the character.
Yeah.
And but I started realizing that in some ways I've known Jason Bourne a lot longer than I've known any of my own characters. You know, mm-hmm. I grew up reading the Ludlum novels. I read The Bourne Identity when I was 17. So, Jason Bourne's been in my life a long time. And I think part of what helped me was two things. In working on the very first book, The Bourne Evolution, I told Tom that there have been so many iterations of Bourne over the years, from the Ludlum novels to Eric von Lustbauer taking over and doing several more, to the Matt Damon movies, even an NBC miniseries with Richard Chamberlain as Jason Bourne in the late 80s, and Jacqueline Smith of Charlie's Angels fame as Marie Saint-Jacques. So many different visions of Bourne. I said, I don't think we want to build on what's come before. I think we want to go back to Ludlum's original creation and vision in The Bourne Identity, take that character and build him out as a very authentic version of this man that we meet in The Bourne Identity, but bring that character forward and put him in an all new modern setting with all new plots and characters around him. So essentially the character feels familiar, but it's also like rebooting the whole series and introducing it again for the first time. That helped a lot. And The Bourne Evolution for me, in a lot of ways, it was kind of an homage to The Bourne Identity. And I was deliberately sort of echoing themes from Ludlum's first novel. I mean, you'll find little Easter eggs throughout the book about The Bourne Identity. And my character of Abby Laurent, who gets involved with Bourne, is inspired by Marie Saint-Jacques as a character in The Bourne Identity. All that worked well in terms of sort of becoming part of the Bourne universe. It was harder than in the second book, in The Bourne Treachery. And I felt like Treachery was coming much more slowly to me than The Bourne Evolution did. And I finally realized that I sort of needed to give myself permission to take ownership of the character and let that character evolve and become a Freeman character as much as a Ludlum character, and be willing to let that character grow and evolve and change based on the things that were happening in my books. And once I kind of, gave myself permission to do that and feel like Jason Bourne was now, a Ludlum character and a Freeman character, then everything started to flow more smoothly because I felt like I could kind of, allow that character to be mine.
So Dom, is that process going to work for you as you are moving? You've got your own character, then you've been writing Jacqueline, and now you're going to move over. I'm having a moment, a senior moment. Vince Flynn's character
Mitch Rapp,
right. Yeah. Does what Brian said seem to resonate with you about how you're going to go about that?
Yeah, and I want to take a step back for a minute and ask your question, or answer your first question, because I was trying to figure out the best way to do it. So I think John Kaczynski is a phenomenal Jack Ryan. I think he's probably the best one since Alec Baldwin played it. And I really like the first series in that, but the ones after that I've had to struggle a little bit more to connect with. And I don't know if it's just me or it feels like it's hopping back and forth. And so I'm very curious to see what they do with this final season. But I guess for me, it's kind of mixed reviews a little bit, unfortunately. From what you were saying about writing for a legacy series, I kind of had it a little bit easier than Brian did, because Brian stepped into the marquee character and had to take on Bourne. I got to take on Jack Ryan Jr., which is a secondary character. And so there's a little bit more wiggle room. And I think when you come to any legacy series, what you're trying to do is find some untilled ground in that series to look around and say, what's something that nobody else has kicked over yet, so that, number one, that it's interesting to the fans. And then number two, as a writer, so that you feel like you can do something that isn't just episodic. And so I think Jack Ryan Jr. was a great way to start to get my feet under me for that, because certainly the Mitch Rapp one is not that. There is no Mark Cameron, who's writing the main story, while I can write the other one, or Brian Freeman, who's writing the main story, write the other one. And so I'm writing my first Mitch Rapp book right now, and it certainly has been more difficult than I thought it would be, just from the standpoint of there is there's a tremendous weight from the fans specifically, where again, with the Clancy one, I thought, you know, even if I really screw this up, Mark Cameron will write a great book and they'll still be fine with it. Where with the Mitch Rapp one, the majority of the people have all been very supportive, but every tweet I get, every social media thing is something along the lines of, this is my favorite character in the world. Do not screw this up. And so, I think, you know, that's part of our job is writing these legacy series. I know Josh Hood, that was writing in the Bourne series for a while, kind of likened it to your dad tossing you the keys to his classic 65 Mustang for the first time. And so you want to drive that car as fast as it'll go, but you want to bring it back to the garage without any new dents in the fender. And so that's what I'm trying to do.
One of the advantages of Bourne as a character in terms of stepping in is the fact that he lost his memory. I mean, honestly, you can't ask for sort of better gold than that as a writer, because there's always things that happened in his past that he doesn't remember that are going to come back and haunt him. So it's the gift that keeps on giving. I really appreciate that bullet he took to the head. That was really good for you.
Okay. Well, sorry, Don. It just seemed like an apropos moment to discuss that.
No.
But carry on with you, and then we'll go back to Brian.
Say, you know, we owe a great debt to that bullet too, Brian, honestly, because Jason Bourne really inspired, in part, Finn's disability with memory, because it allows us to bring in stuff with every new book that, you know, we may not have conceived of at first, but hey, as you say, it's kind of a free area for us. So yeah, thank you to that bullet.
So I wanted to jump back, Brandon and John, and something you guys were saying about your first book and how the atmosphere or the setting played such an important role, that you were on an aircraft carrier, because Puerto Rico is, you know, it sounds trite to say it's a character in the book, but it very much is a character in your book. And so when I'm looking, one of my closest friends is Puerto Rican. And the things that she would say, or the things that she would echo about Puerto Rico and about what life is like there and kind of the disparity is echoed in your book. And I kept thinking, I'm like, I don't think either of these guys are Puerto Rican. And so how did Puerto Rico become the setting? And then how did you guys figure out what it was like to be a native of Puerto Rico?
So I think I'll let Brandon go first, on that one.
Yeah. So up until the pandemic, I was a Puerto Rico resident. So I had 8 years between Manhattan and Puerto Rico. So in part of what John and I do like to do is go deep in the setting. Mm-hmm. And so as we were talking about, okay, what does book three look like? Where's Finn running to? Puerto Rico is a natural choice for me because I knew how many Americans had no idea, like the Navy even had a base there. They don't even think it's part of America, which it is. It's a Commonwealth, has a crazy interesting history and relationship with the U.S. Even though everyone on Puerto Rico is a citizen, it's very much its own country. At least it feels that way. And so that's what gave us the idea, and it was important to me as well to kind of project how complicated and interesting Puerto Rico is to the reader, and teach them about the island, you know, teach them about the history. Yeah. I'm a Michener fan. And one of the things I loved about being a kid on a sailboat with no television was just like, I wish history class was taught by Michener, you know, in a way of just like, making history super fascinating and interesting, and you're reading a novel, but you're actually learning about the history of Hawaii, South Pacific, Alaska. So, that's why Puerto Rico came into the picture, and I think we do a pretty good job describing the island.
I think I have a great advantage as a writer in all the things I don't know about. Mm-hmm. So, kind of how we work together is Brandon and I brainstorm on this, the context and the premise and some of the big plot points. And typically there's some big reveal at the near the end of the book that is something, you know, we talk about at the very beginning. Then at a certain point, he kind of hands it over to me to start filling in. And like, he served 6 months on the Abraham Lincoln. I was on it for a day. Mm. He's been to Iceland. I couldn't go. It was a pandemic happening. I tried to go. I couldn't go. He lived in Puerto Rico. I went for 3 days. And so what my job is to take this environment that I really know nothing about and learn as much about it as I can. And I think that's an advantage because I have to learn it well enough so that I know how to introduce it to a reader who doesn't know anything about it, because if I'm going to learn it, they're going to learn it. If they're going to learn it, I'm going to learn it. So I'm kind of in, they're kind of in my shoes and I'm kind of in their shoes. So it was really fascinating to learn about this place that I knew nothing about. And as you say, Don, like, understand what's the life of a Puerto Rican like? What's their history and their sociology and their desperation and their frustration and their subjugation over the centuries and all this stuff? What does that look like today? So yeah, it was a blast. We love going deep into a new place.
Sorry, Don. I was just
go ahead, Barbara.
Is it fair to say that one of the attractions of reading books like this is the international aspect, you know, that they are not static, they're not set in Cabot's Cove, but you know, you get to arrange, like Brian's book, we're in Alaska, we go to the Bahamas, you know, I think I call them international thrillers. It's just kind of a shorthand for the idea that the action, you know, is moving around, and also you can introduce a lot more fresh things if you're not in a static location. Although you can't explore the static location to the depth, perhaps, that you could if you had several books set there. But I don't know. Anyway, I think readers like that. I always try to mention when I'm, you know, selling books along these lines, I always try to mention where they take you, because I think that's part of the attraction.
The reader gets to travel.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And honestly, for readers that have been there, that's something they always mention when they're sending emails. Oh, yeah, I was right in that place. So,
Yeah.
Anyway, sorry, it just seemed to me that was a commonality in what we're talking about tonight.
No, and I'd even take that a step further, because I think, especially going back to the original Bourne books, you know, obviously that was pre-internet, pre-everything. And so that the amount of like mystique and foreign for a kid who grew up in the Midwest and had never traveled anywhere, and you can read about it and get it described, I think you're absolutely right. Like, that's part of what makes that genre, is that sense of, I'm going to take you to Vienna or somewhere in, you know, in Europe or somewhere else that you've never been to and only read about, and show you what it looks like. And I think Brian does that in a fantastic way in the Bourne books. And I think Brandon and John did it very, very well in Blind Fear, for sure. One of the other things y'all, so John and Brandon, y'all were talking about your creative process and kind of working through the setting. The other thing I wanted to talk to you about is this book has some very weighty, heavy topics in it. You know, everything from war crimes in Yemen to corruption and policing to, you know, smuggling and trafficking. And honestly, like, any one of these things could have been a book in itself. I guess, talk to us a little bit about why all of this is in here, or how it comes to be, or how these things surface in the book as you guys are writing it.
Well, I mean, one of the things that I enjoy about fiction more than nonfiction, one, I don't have to submit it for a Department of Defense review to get redacted, so I can write about things that I know to be true that you know, I don't need permission to put in a book. So there's that. I think, you know, again, Puerto Rico, it's interesting. It's the location of it, the fact that there's a lot of dodgy stuff happening in Puerto Rico. There's the airport, the international airport is owned by a Mexican company, right, that own and operate the airport. You can just use your imagination, right? And this stuff is for real. And so, you know, as far as the, you know, on the war crime stuff, you can cover heavy topics like that. And again, you can do it in a very creative way and not have the consequences of doing it in a nonfiction book, which, I mean, if anyone's written nonfiction, I can tell you, it's like walking through a minefield blindfolded. It's like, I didn't know my dad was going to get upset about this. I didn't know this friend was going to be pissed off. I named him in the book. So fiction, you can have a lot more creativity and use the real stuff. John and I have so much rich life experience to draw off of and such different backgrounds. Mm-hmm. I think it makes for the magic of what we do.
Yeah, you know, there's a scene right at the end of Steel Fear, the first book, the aircraft carrier book. There's a scene where Master Chief Jackson, the chief non-com on board, is reflecting about how, basically it comes down to, he reflects about how, you know, they travel around the world in this aircraft carrier facing off all kinds of enemies, but that the greatest enemy that he'd face was one of them, was from within. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that, you know, kind of to your question, Don, about all this police corruption and war crimes. I think the idea of the guys who were supposed to be the good guys and supposed to be watching out for us and protecting us, that they're flawed. And in some cases, mm-hmm. they're really, you know, terribly flawed, is a really gripping one. It's one that's certainly current. It's one we've been dealing with a whole lot in our public life in the last number of years, with police and military issues and so on. And I think it kind of intrigues us. And then with Finn, it's kind of like, are there demons within himself? And it's exciting to fight a bad guy like the Russians or the Arabs or the other guy. Mm-hmm. But there's something that's really kind of complicated and in that way satisfying about facing off the enemy within our own ranks. And I think that's something that kind of draws. Brandon knows it firsthand within the military. Mm-hmm. I only know it to the extent that every human being knows what it's like to be betrayed by somebody that you thought you were supposed to trust.
Yeah.
Oh, you just set up Brian's plot here, because it appears that, why don't you tell us just briefly, I could do it, but it's your book, so you should do it, about the Bourne Defiance. I'll get it right this time.
Yeah, I think that's sort of Bourne's primary lesson in life: trust no one, since he's been betrayed constantly over and over again. But fortunately, you know, he keeps finding, you know, women that will also betray him. So
I can relate to that.
the Bourne Defiance it's the fourth one that I've done, and a lot of the threads from the first three books kind of come to a head in this novel, and it kicks off with the idea that Treadstone agents around the world are being hunted down and killed, and Bourne seems to be on the target list, and he discovers this from his former lover and Treadstone agent Nova. One of those women who betrayed him in the second book, as they try to find out what's going on and who's targeting them, they discover that this seems to be connected to a Treadstone mission from the past that was codenamed Defiance, and nobody was ever really clear who was giving the orders on Defiance. And Bourne, of course, once again, fortunately, doesn't have that memory, so he doesn't know what was really going on with Defiance. But as it turns out, the one man that seems to have the answers to what was going on back then is, in fact, his nemesis for the past three books, the Russian assassin who calls himself Lenin, as in Lennon, one of those charming killers who likes to whistle Beatles songs while he's killing people and torturing people. And so it sets up this wonderful cat and mouse game between Bourne and Lennon throughout the book, leading to this sort of final climactic confrontation between the two of them.
Wow, is that sounds kind great. Of the end of a cycle, Brian?
I'm sorry, what was that?
Is that kind of the end of a site, you know, a story arc that you'll be?
Yeah, it is pretty deliberately too. I wanted to be able to sort of wrap up a lot of what I'd done in the first few books and have a chance to sort of go back to ground and build up new plot threads and new characters starting in book five. Because I think particularly when you're talking about a series that it has been going on as long as Bourne has, and has again gone through so many iterations, I think it's useful to sort of reboot every few books, because it allows more readers to come in and become part of the party. And if you're clinging to too many threads from earlier books, it's harder for readers to kind of jump in the middle, and they kind of sort of feel like they've been missing something along the way. So in my idea, you know, I like to be able to sort of, you know, reground the character every few novels. So I wanted the Defiance book to really tie up a lot of the threads that have been going on since the Bourne Evolution, and then in number five have a chance to kind of start fresh. And some of the characters will reappear as we go forward, but at the same time, it's kind of a once again a new beginning for the series.
So is it a given in the Bourne books that Jason Bourne's always going to be alone? I mean, is a reset always going to take him back to, you know, Jason?
Well, it kind of depends on how you define alone. You know, I think when you look at the Matt Damon movies, I think one of the key differences between the movies and the character as Ludlum built him out was that you really have Matt Damon portraying Bourne as this recluse and the loner, and that's really not who he is as a character in the Ludlum novels. I mean, he's actually somebody that needs, you know, somebody in his life, and Marie St. Jacques, his wife in the Ludlum books, is you know, a core part of who Bourne is, and it's she becomes an important part of the entire series. I wanted to be able to do that too, and so I've introduced Bourne's relationships in the books, and even when he's kind of fighting this and feeling that, you know, it's not safe to involve another person in his world, at the same time, he's someone that wants that relationship, and he's constantly sort of feeling himself drawn back into that world. And so Abby and Nova become such important parts of the books. And Abby in particular, I think, is a character that Bourne wants to push away because he doesn't think it's safe for her to be involved with him. And yet at the same time, he's clearly in love with her and so finds himself kind of drawn back into her circle.
That's neat that you can create those characters, because Don, one of the challenges in writing the Ryan thing is the whole family thing. I mean, there's Kathy and there's, you know, all those characters. So you don't get just Jack, you know, senior or junior.
Yeah.
You get a whole kind of ensemble cast from the campus and the whole bit.
You do. And that's one of the things. And I think Brian would agree that Tom Colgan is such a great guy to work for, because he lets you as a writer propose crazy things and chase them. And then he kind of serves as the guardrails to bring them back in. But one of the points I made to him when I was writing my first Clancy book that was called Target Acquired is that there is such a big cast of characters and so many storied characters, right? That each, and some of these characters had their own spinoffs of their own books. And I said, you know, to me, it's kind of like an Avengers movie, where when you had Robert Downey Jr. in the very first Iron Man, it was all him and it was incredible. But when you bring 12 or 14 other people in there, it all gets watered down somewhat. And so what I pitched to him for my first Jack Ryan book was a very tightly focused book just on Jack Ryan Jr. And so he went for that, and it allowed me to kind of figure him out as a writer and to go deeper into him as a character and do more of his story. And so now across the four book arc that I've written, so Weapons Grade will be my fourth book as a Jack Ryan, I've been able to develop him more as a character and give him more of a character arc. And there are still some, again, when you're the marquee guy like Mark Cameron or now Anderson Wilson or Brian, you don't have as much of a luxury to bring in ancillary characters. I was able to, there's a pair of Green Berets, Jad and Carrie, that I brought in the first book I needed to tell a portion of a story and I wanted to have some humor, and the readers liked them so much and they were so much fun to write that they've now been, and they're going to be in the fourth book, every single one. And so you get to do that a little bit more when you're the guy off stage doing this other series. I think probably Mark Cameron and the Anderson Wilson guys, and I don't want to speak for Brian, I don't know what your take on it is, Brian, but I think when you're the marquee writer for that series, to your point, Barbara, you face some more limitations perhaps. Was that your experience, Brian?
Actually, I really was fortunate in that the both Tom and the Ludlum Estate really kind of gave me a lot of free rein to go my own way with the character. And again, part of it is there had not been a single sort of character arc for Bourne. You know, Ludlum had a character arc through his three books, but based on, you know, what was going on at the end of Ultimatum, there's really nothing that you can build off of that part of the arc. Then, you know, Eric did the same thing with his series of Bourne books and brought in new characters. And then the movies added in a whole new wrinkle into the equation because they did their own take on the Bourne story. And that was how so many people got to know who Bourne was as a character. So as a result, there was no natural there was no natural history to actually build on, and that kind of gave me the opportunity to really focus more on recreating the authentic character, but able, you know, I was able to sort of build a whole new story arc and all new characters around him, and so that's been great, and it's because I've moved Bourne into the modern era, I'm sort of tiptoeing into the idea of starting to kind of work with his backstory, and you know, clearly you can't have the original Bourne backstory working in 2023, because you know, Bourne's story went back to Vietnam and the Watergate era and everything that was going on in the 1970s. So I'm sort of, you know, talking about the fact that, you know, a few years ago he had this this incident where he was shot and lost his memory, but I'm starting to sort of layer in a new approach to what his backstory really was to sort of start folding over from you know, a 70s era backstory that really doesn't work anymore. So, you know, I've been able to work in sort of Bourne losing his parents on 9/11, and David Abbott, who was a character that created Treadstone and the Bourne Identity, you know, was sort of his father figure and helped him through. And now in the fifth book that I'm writing right now, I'm having the opportunity to kind of go back and do an origin story for David Webb, who was, you know, born before he actually joined Treadstone. And so it kind of, I have the opportunity to kind of create a new origin story, you know, again, bringing it forward. And so again, for me, that's actually been kind of an advantage that I didn't have my hands tied, you know, by all of these characters having already been in place.
So it's a little bit of a wrinkle too, where I wondered if you, since you and Josh Hood write in the same universe, whether you guys have to deconflict or not, because Mark Cameron and I, and Mark's a mountain of a man who used to be a man hunter and was a US Marshal. And so I try and tread lightly around him too, but in Flashpoint, I really upset the apple cart and I upset it as I was writing and Mark was trying to write his own book. And so there was at one point I told him what I was going to do. And I think he was less than happy, but he's a great guy. And so then I made it even worse. So I actually have a text message from Mark Cameron that says, "Is everyone at least ambulatory at the end of your book? Because I got to know." And so that's kind of what you're dealing with when you're working in the same universe. Do you and Josh have those problems, or are you guys kind of walled off from each other?
You know, we you know, kind of text back and forth, but it hasn't really caused any problems for us because he's really focused on the Treadstone side of the universe, and I'm kind of got Bourne at arm's length from Treadstone at this point. He's you know, mostly out, a little bit in when you know, things are happening, like other Treadstone agents being killed. But I can work in a couple of references to, you know, to characters that Josh created, and he'll throw in the occasional reference to Bourne. But otherwise, they kind of work on parallel paths, and so it hasn't really caused any problems for us.
That's fascinating, man. That's all that is just fascinating. Yeah, incredible.
But one of the things, you know, that I've observed over the years is if you're going to write a series, there are a couple of people who have tried to write a series where the main character never acquires other characters as attachments. Barry Eisler's first book, I can't at this point remember the name of it, but, you know, the idea was that this guy was going to be the total loner. But of course, it didn't work out. I mean, Greg Hurwitz has, you know, started out with Orphan X as that kind of a character. But pretty soon, you know, there's you know, the woman and the kid in the building, and there's, you know, other stuff. I think it's very hard to write a series without creating other characters in addition to the lead.
I think it's pretty hard to be a human being without having other people in your life. So I don't know how we would go about creating a character that's a pure loner like that. Cause I just, you know, is there anyone that really exists in that kind of world? I think it would feel unnatural if you stuck to that. I think it it makes the characters more interesting as you start to have them deal with those sort of natural human emotions.
Yeah, it was the Rain Man. It now comes back to me. But, you know, I mean, but it's that sort of Superman problem. You know, if everybody around him will be in jeopardy when he moves from being Clark Kent to Superman, mm-hmm. you know, that becomes a real problem if you've got some kind of action hero that may then create life-threatening situations for people attached to him. So how do you keep, Greg has to deal with that with the woman whose name I can't remember in the building and the kid, you know, for
yeah, the attorney. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that's a real problem. If you've got somebody mm-hmm. that's always going to be in jeopardy himself and put everybody else in jeopardy, then yeah. that's going to weigh on your relationships.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that's right. And you can only, and you have to be careful too, because you can only do that once, right? It can only be the wife or girlfriend or boyfriend or spouse that's in jeopardy. You can't go back and visit that again, because then it's stale or the readers, you know, feel like they've been there before. So yeah, absolutely. I agree with you.
Or you just kill them off and then start over again. Wife number two.
Back the bodies.
Just a hint for you guys, in case Finn decides to, you know, acquire more people. You've got a lesson here right now.
That's something Vince Flynn used himself. He killed off Mitch's first wife when she was pregnant. So not so far-fetched.
Well, look at Brad Thor. I was talking about him before we started. By the way, you two guys, Brad sent you his regards, Web and Man here, and said how much he likes your series.
It is certainly true. I think probably the most dangerous occupation in pretty much any thriller is hero's wife. So
well, Brad killed off, you know, Scott Harpo's wife, and yeah. now he has a girlfriend, the Norwegian ninja, whose name, you know, I think is a great character. But and what also, they're competing dynamics in relationships too, you know, especially mm-hmm. male female. If you know, woman has more of a nesting instinct, or there's children involved or something, then yeah. that makes it even more complicated.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, Don, do you have killer questions to wrap us up before we move to, you know, seeing what the audience might want to ask?
I do. The last thing I want to ask y'all is, we talked about some of the really heavy topics, but I think one of the things that makes this very unique is the brother and sister, so Miranda and Pedro, who are very integral to the book. And so I'm curious whether those two characters are very well drawn, whether they come from perhaps your children or children that you know. And then secondly, why was it, we were just talking about loners and kind of the loner mentality, why was it important for you guys to have Finn have kind of a pseudo family in this book?
John, you want to take that one?
Sure. I mean, there's so much there. I think Brandon and I both have our own take, because we both have kids. And, you know, it's funny, Brandon had called me with this idea. He said, I have this image of a young boy and girl swimming in the coastal waters, tropical waters, and disappearing. And my wife, you probably read this in the back of the book, my wife and I had just bought, like 2 weeks earlier, this painting from a Bolivian artist of this little boy and girl swimming in tropical waters. It was like made my hair on my back of my neck go up when Brandon said this. So we were both in the same wavelength. I didn't know anything about these kids. Brandon has kids that he dives with. I have kids. But I think that, you know, Finn is evolving. Finn is changing. He's going from this almost like Rain Man-like place in book one to discovering that he can maybe even be a friend. He thought that was impossible. Mm-hmm. And the idea of exploring an attachment to these other two kids, part of that, I think, is that he's reaching back and trying to kind of figure out his own childhood and sort of become a whole person, or at least get closer to being a whole person. And, you know, God knows we're all rooting for him to do that. So I think his relationship with those two kids, they don't actually physically come together until the very end of the book. But I think, to me, it was like the most compelling thing about writing it. And it wasn't there in the beginning. Like, we didn't have this idea to start with. It just kind of, it's one of those things that grew in the course of writing the book.
No, it was so well done. It was so well done. And I guess my last question before we throw it to the audience is, what's next for the two of you? What are you guys working on next?
Oh, I think we're going to Malta.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, you know, we look for new places every time, and we'll just say that we think Malta is going to be involved. There may be a good deal of underwater. We want to get back to the SEAL's roots, you know, the old UDT guys, and do some serious underwater sequences. And there is governmental corruption. There are bad guys. There is an ancient dungeon. And if we said any more than that, we'd have to kill all the listeners. So,
Malta has such a fabulous history. I've been there two or three times. It's like a pivot point and a central point in the Mediterranean. It was crucial for the British, you know, the Knights of Malta, their caves and tunnels, all kinds of, you can have
torture chambers.
Yeah. Right. one of the great sieges of all time in military history took place on Malta. So there are probably echoes of it that, you know, you can go back to. So, Don, we already know what you're doing next because you're in the middle of it. You're writing your first Mitch Rapp book. Brian, are you going to do another Jonathan Stride book? You talked about you're doing a fifth Bourne and you have a couple of standalones for Blackstone. But what's up with Jonathan Stride?
The last Jonathan Stride was the Zero Night that came out last November, and then I actually wrapped up a new standalone for Blackstone called Break Every Rule that will be out next year, along with the fifth Jason Bourne novel, and then I'm not sure what I'm going to do next for Blackstone. We have to talk about that. Is do I do another Stride novel? Do I do another standalone? We haven't wrapped that up yet. So watch this space.
Okay, I know. I followed his career forever. Brian and I have been together. Actually, Don and I have been together for every book. And Brian and I have been together for almost all of them. There was one interesting point when the Jonathan Strides were published in the UK, but not the US. So we imported them.
Took a year and a half on the Cold Nowhere before it got around to the US. Right,
you know, so we stuck with him.
That's crazy.
We're loyal. Right. So, Patrick, come and join us and let us know in this somewhat disjointed but actually fascinating conversation whether the audience stayed with us or if they have any questions.
They definitely stayed with you, but you have, I think you've all answered most of the questions. Donna says, I bet there's so many people that love to point out the impossibility of the newborn backstory. Silly people. I have the same mental dilemma with other fabulous series, but I truly want them to be as young as they need to be to remain relevant.
I do every now and then get emails from readers who wonder how could Bourne be, you know, in his mid-30s. I'm like, well, yeah. He first hit the scene and is probably in his mid-30s in 1980. So I don't really know that. I don't know. I mean, I guess I should never say never. I mean, Liam Neeson seems to be able to play, you know, action roles until he's old and gray. But I don't really think Bourne in his late 70s would quite have the same appeal.
It's the same as the Spencer syndrome with Robert Parker. He started out, you know, in Korea. The Korean War.
Time travel.
Yeah, that's, Harry Bosch was in Vietnam, but Michael is kind of taking him out of, you know, more serious action roles.
Afghanistan now and the tunnels there.
Yeah. I think readers, most readers, are happy to go along with the idea that characters can age in a way different, you know, at a different speed.
Yeah, I mean, with my Stride series, Stride pulls off a wonderful trick, because when my first Stride novel came out, Stride was quite a bit older than I was, and now here we are 20 years later, and I am quite a bit older than Stride, so.
Genius of the Bond franchise.
Yeah,
that's right. We have a plausible action hero that is... Although, you know, if you're paying attention, there is the whole senior sleuth movement going on. And I will tell you, Saturday, Spencer Quinn, a.k.a. Peter Abrahams, one of my favorite authors, is bringing us Mrs. Plotsky's Revenge. And Mrs. Plotsky is a 70-year-old widow who gets scammed out of her life savings by a guy in Romania and goes to Romania and retrieves her money in her motorcycle chase in the Transylvania Mountains. It's amazing.
It sounds like Mrs. Palifax,
you know,
I think.
You know, you've got a, Deanna Raeburn's Killers of a Certain Age is a great spy novel. So there is a kind of a, you know, road here for older sleuths. Look at Harrison Ford blazing a trail for us, you know. And although I was irritated when I checked out of the Safeway today and there was a one of those, you know, newspaper things, Harrison Ford, you know, the greatest action hero of all time. And I thought, what happened to John Wayne? I mean, I'm reflecting my own age, you know. If you were looking for action, man, it was going to be John Wayne for decades.
Yeah.
Let's can't remember that back that far.
or Clint Eastwood. It's hard to imagine.
Clint Eastwood, yeah.
Him aging out now, but
he's in his 90s, but still, but you know.
Still a badass.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No question.
All right. Any other? I mean, Mrs. Plotsky really is an amazing book. So I'm truly looking forward to talking about it on Saturday with Michael Corrida, who's also a fascinating author and a real chameleon.
I have this image that this teacher is going to wrap my knuckles. That's what her name in books.
Well, remember Daniel Silva was talking a little bit about that in terms of people wanting to adapt his character for Hollywood or for TV, you know, and he was saying, I'm willing to do this, this, and this. I'm willing to update him to the current, you know, but there are certain things that he wouldn't do. Let's see, anybody else here? Well, Don, I think you already answered this, but Valerie is asking, for Don, now that you're working on Mitch Rapp, are you passing the torch on to someone else for Jack Jr.?
So you'll have to stay tuned on that. I am not writing the next Jack Jr. Books for sure, but I don't think we're allowed to say any more than that at this point.
Uh-huh. Barbara, do you know?
I do.
Barbara knows everything.
And the reason I know is that I was so ugly to Don and Kyle Mills, who stood there and didn't tell me when it was announced the next day that they were doing the handoff, that Don warding off, warding off, really
did
off again.
Especially, especially I Kyle, too am
sworn to secrecy.
Is there an ampersand in the name, perhaps? All right, there you
they
go.
Are so Andrews and Wilson are doing the taking Mark over Cameron. For Mark Cameron for sure. Yeah, that's already been announced.
Okay, great. Let me just jump over to YouTube real quick. Interesting question. Here's a question for Brian from Fred. He wants to know, when you write the Bourne books, are you visioning Matt Damon or Jeremy Renner in your mind?
Not really, no. I actually, and not Richard Chamberlain also, I confess. No, I don't try to picture any of the actual actors in there, although I write the description of the character in such a way that if there are Matt Damon fans out there who want to sort of picture, you know, Matt Damon in the Bourne role, they can do that. But that I'm not thinking of him in that role, mostly because, again, as I said earlier, I think that the Matt Damon vision of Bourne was very different from the Ludlum vision of Bourne. And I think I'm trying to bring Ludlum's Bourne into these novels and not Matt Damon's version. So he can look a little like Matt Damon, but I'm actually, you know, trying to go back and just sort of keep the Bourne identity Bourne in my head.
But that's reborn. The same issue that Don and the other Jack Ryan writers are facing, is that, you know, the movie versions, of which there have been multiple film versions anyway, you can't let them dictate. And besides, you know, you wind up with different characters. I mean, the current Jack Ryan Jr. On film is apparently retired, or at least says it's the last one for him. So who knows who might take it over next. And then, you know, if you try to tailor it to just one guy, then it can go south on you. Yeah.
Now, mind you, I think it's about time. You know, we've got Jack Reacher coming back. We've got, you know, Jack Ryan coming back. It really is time that Jason Bourne reemerges here on either film. We're overdue here. So
I agree. But Hollywood is a tough dance partner.
Yeah.
I'm currently sitting on the sidelines, guys. So, you know, till they settle the double strike, Hollywood and in fact all film projects except the ones that were already in the pipeline I just had lunch with David Morrell in Santa Fe, and Jack, you know, was beaming in, Jack Carr, his big fan. And it turns out that Creepers is completed, David's movie. So it will get to
know. Wow.
But, you know, there are a lot of projects. I read today that George R.R. Martin, who had, you know, who will never apparently finish the series that he was writing, but nonetheless was under contract to write something about dragons. And now it's been put on, you know, suspension because nothing. So, you know, who knows how this is all going to come out and what role AI will turn out to play, because the last writer's strike gave us reality TV, which you can then take in different directions. And so AI may get a huge boost, you know, from this absence. So, you know, there are always risks whenever ever anything like this happens. I'm grateful that UPS decided to settle, because I really didn't want to. We last a week ago Thursday, two trucks rolled up and dropped off 3,700 books at
100
at the back of the bookstore for two authors, you know, for two August events. And, you know, it was like, oh my God, what are we supposed to do with all this?
Oh, no.
So, you know, I mean, truthfully, we are all more and more at risk for, you know, for forces and decisions made by others that that we can't control. Yeah. It's a global world, a global economy, and your books need to reflect that, don't they?
Yeah.
They can't be parochial.
Our pub day got pushed because of the pending strike. They moved us 1 week earlier so they could get the shipping out.
Yes, well, you should see our calendar. It's like dominoes, you know, it's shuffling all around. But it, you know, in theory, it won't happen. And although I think it still needs to be approved, and then we'll kind of go back to normal. But anyway, global, as I said, international thrillers, same thing. Finally, Patrick, anything else?
Let's see. Carrie asks, can we start with Blind Fear, or is it better to start with Steel Fear?
You can start with any. Yeah, they're all three of them are self-contained stories. But if you have the choice and you want to make the choice, I would, you know, recommend starting with the first one and working your way through, because there is an arc to the three of them.
All right. Barbara, I was gonna ask you, have you heard anything about a new Dan Brown book?
Oh, I haven't, but I now have a sort of a pipeline through which I can inquire. But I'm sure that if I knew anything, I wouldn't be allowed to say it anyhow. But no, not at the moment.
It's been a minute since his last one, hasn't it?
Has been a long time. But remember Thomas Harris? It was like 10 years, you know, after Silence of the Lambs. Sometimes, you know, books just don't come.
Well, you know.
Did you see Terry Hayes finally has the sequel to I Am Pilgrim?
Well, so I'll believe that when I actually get my hands.
So David Brown announced it. He said it was in Emily's hands and it was going to be in 2024.
Really?
So I think that one's been 15 years, right?
It's been a really long time. And I can still remember the way it was sold to me, because we bought a lot of copies, that it was going to be, you know, a series of the whole bit. And then, you know,
then
5 years later, write reproachfully and say, so I bought, I am a pilgrim. What happened? And, you know, whatever. Creativity is not on demand, you know, creativity. Yeah. It comes or it doesn't. And, you know, for some writers,
you're talking to keep going.
Brian?
Yeah, I don't know, though. Not being creative tends to get in the way of my eating. So
I was going to say, the mortgage does come
everybody's
on demand.
So works differently. And, you know, Brian and Don both, you know, are really able to write frequently and well. You know, and that isn't always true. Frequently and well don't always go together, but in you two case, it does. And then other people, you know, really have to take a long time to work things out. But yes, I would be very excited to see finally the sequel.
I love that book.
I did too. I thought it was remarkable. I often too think that sometimes if you have a really huge success, especially with a first novel, it's extremely hard.
To venture a
second novel, you know, because the expectations for it can be absolutely.
Remember Scott Smith's book, The Simple Plan? Yeah. Very simple plan. I guess he did have one follow-up, but...
It was the ruins after that, wasn't it?
Yeah, the ruins.
Mm-hmm. Well, To Kill a Mockingbird is the obvious example here, you know? Mm-hmm. Or even Gone with the Wind, although she died, so we'll never really know whether Margaret Mitchell would have written another
book. Can't hold that one against it.
Yeah. Well, we're wandering, guys. I mean, digression is the fun for all of this, but still. I know it's very late in New York, so I want to thank both John and Brandon for being willing to stay up after their earlier event and talk to us. And so John in Austin and Brian in Florida and our other two guys in New York and Patrick and me in Scottsdale, we're our own international thriller group right here. Thank you very, very much. Again, I'll repeat that we have signed copies of The Burn Defiance. Notice I got it right again. The Burn Defiance at the store. And shortly we will have copies of Blind Fear wandering in from New York. So good night, everybody. Thanks for joining us. Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.